Rewind. Play.
We still on for tonight?
Absolutely. Where?
All bar one. Leicester Square, 9 o'clock.
I'll be there. Gabrielle picked up the telephone and punched in the number for Isherwood Fine Arts. Leicester Square, London. Jacqueline arrived at All Bar One 5 minutes after Yusuf and his friend had arrived. She bought herself a glass of wine and sat down. Yusuf feasted on her with his eyes. A few moments later, he disengaged himself from the blonde girl he had been chatting up. He walked over to Jacqueline and asked if he could join her. It was as easy as that. At midnight, they were walking across Leicester Square together in a swirling wind. Jacqueline shivered and folded her arms beneath her breasts. Yusuf put an arm around her waist and pulled her against him. She could feel the wine. She had found that judicious use of alcohol helped in situations like these. She had drunk just enough to lose any inhibitions about sleeping with a complete stranger, inhibitions that might betray her, but not enough to dull her senses or instincts of self-preservation. They climbed into a taxi on the Charing Cross Road. Jacqueline said,
"Where do you live?"
She knew the answer, but Dominique Bonnard did not. "I have a flat in Bayswater, Sussex Gardens. Shall we go there?" She nodded. She traced her finger along his jaw.
"You're quite beautiful, you know."
He smiled. She thought,
"He's used to compliments from women."
The taxi arrived in front of his building. It was a charmless place, a flat-fronted post-war blockhouse with an air of institutional decay. He helped her out of the taxi, paid off the driver, led her up a short flight of steps to the front entrance. He walked on the balls of his feet, like Gabrielle, she thought, as if he were perpetually prepared to lunge or pounce. Was Gabrielle watching from his observation post, she wondered. Yusuf removed his keys, singled out one for the front door, Yale model, she noted, and inserted it into the chamber. He led her across a small lobby, then up dimly lit stairs. At the door of his flat, he used a second Yale to unlock the deadbolt, then an old-fashioned skeleton for the latch. 3 locks, 3 separate keys. No problem. When they entered the flat, he kissed her for the first time, and Jacqueline said,
"I've wanted you to do that all night. You have beautiful lips."
"I've wanted to do other things all night," he said. He switched on a light and said he was going to open a bottle of wine. Jacqueline quickly surveyed the room as Shamron had taught her to do. 3 cheap oriental carpets over the linoleum floor, mismatched chairs, a coffee table of pressboard atop gray cinder blocks, an ashtray the size of a dinner plate, posters of Bob Marley and Che Guevara, a black, green, and red Palestinian flag. Everywhere there were books, Middle East history, histories of the Middle East wars, biographies of Arafat, Sadat, Ben-Gurion, Rabin.
"You read a great deal," she called to him.
"It's an addiction of mine."
"Where are you from, if you don't mind my asking?"
"Palestine." He came into the room from the kitchen and handed her a glass of red wine. Then he held out his hand. "Come with me." Gabrielle stood in his window. Karp's laser microphone picked up snatches of their conversation, but it was like listening to a vinyl record album that skipped. When they moved to the bedroom to make love, Gabrielle said, "Shut it off."
"But Gabe, it's just getting to the good part."
"I said shut it off." 1 hour later, Yusuf climbed out of bed, walked to the window, and opened the curtains. The yellow street lamp had turned his olive skin the color of old newsprint. Jacqueline lay on her stomach. She placed her chin atop her hands and looked at him, eyes following the line from his square shoulders to his lean, muscular waist. She wondered if Gabrielle was looking at him, too. Yusuf was watching the street, looking into parked cars, scanning the building opposite. He turned his body slightly, and she could see a wide, flat scar on his back, running between his right shoulder blade and the center of his ridged spine. She had felt it when they were making love. It was hard and coarse, like sandpaper, like the skin of a shark. He had been a gentle lover, meticulous in his attempts to give her pleasure. When he was inside her, she had closed her eyes and imagined it was Gabriel, and when she felt the scar between his shoulder blades, she imagined it was Gabriel's scar, a relic from one of his secret missions, and she wished that she could pass her hand over it and make it go away.
"What are you looking at?" she asked.
Yusuf turned around and folded his arms across his chest.
"Have you ever slept with an Arab before, Dominique?"
She thought,
"And you're changing the subject."
She said,
"You're my first. I may do it again sometime."
"Not while you're sleeping with me."
"Are we sleeping together now?"
"That's up to you."
"All right, we are now officially sleeping together."
She rolled onto her back, looked at the light from the street falling across her body, imagined it was Gabrielle's gaze.
"Do you think we should get to know each other a little better, now that we're officially sleeping together?"
He smiled and said, "What do you want to know?"
"I want to know what happened to your back."
He turned and looked out the window. She studied the digital alarm clock on the bedside table.
"There are some things about my past that you might find unpleasant," he said.
"Bad things you've done?"
"No, Dominique. Bad things that were done to me."
"How did you get that scar on your back?"
He turned and looked at her.
"I grew up in a refugee camp in Lebanon, the Shatila camp in South Beirut. Perhaps you've heard of Shatila, Dominique."
"Of course I've heard of Shatila."
"The PLO had offices in the Shatila camp. So when the Israelis invaded Lebanon in 82, they shelled the camp day and night. A missile fired by an Israeli fighter jet hit the building where our family lived. The building collapsed on top of me, and a chunk of concrete tore away the skin of my back."
"Why were you in Lebanon?"
"Because that's where my family ended up after they were driven from their ancestral homes in Palestine by the Jews."
Jacqueline looked at the ceiling.
Yusuf said, "Why do you look away from me when I tell you that?"
"I met some Israelis once in a nightclub in Paris. They were debating this issue with a group of French students. They said that the Jews didn't have to expel the Arabs from Palestine because the Arabs left on their own."
Yusuf laughed and shook his head.
"I'm afraid you have fallen for the great Zionist myth, Dominique. The myth that the Palestinians would voluntarily trade the land where they had lived for centuries for exile and refugee camps. The myth that the Arab governments told the Palestinians to leave."
"It's not true."
"Does it sound as though it could be true?"
It was while he was in the shower in the morning that she reached into her purse for her mascara case. She picked up Yusuf's keys from the makeshift coffee table. She placed the first of them, the one he had used at the street entrance, atop the soft ceramic material inside the mascara case, closed the lid, and squeezed. She opened the case and removed the key. The imprint was flawless. She repeated the process two more times, once with the second Yale key, then with the skeleton. She had three perfect imprints. She closed the lid, placed the keys exactly where Yusuf had left them, then returned the mascara case to her purse.
"What are you doing there?"
She looked up, startled, and quickly regained her composure. Yusuf was standing in the center of the floor, his wet body wrapped in a beige bath towel. How long had he been standing there? How much had he seen?
"Damn it, Jacqueline! Why weren't you watching the door?"
She said,
"I'm looking for my cigarettes. Have you seen them?"
He pointed toward the bedroom.
"You left them in there."
"Oh, yes. God, sometimes I think I'm losing my mind."
"That's all you were doing? Just looking for cigarettes?"
"What else would I be doing?"
She spread her arms to indicate the Spartan squalor of his sitting room.
"You think I'm trying to make off with your valuables?"
She stood and picked up her handbag.
"Are you finished in the bathroom?"
"Yes, but why are you bringing your purse to the bathroom?"
She thought,
"He suspects something."
Suddenly, she wanted to get out of the flat as quickly as possible. Then she thought,
I should be offended by questions like that.
I think I may be getting my period, she said icily. I don't think I like the way you're acting. Is this the way all Arab men treat their lovers the morning after?
She brushed past him and entered the bedroom. She was surprised at how convincing she had managed to sound. Her hands were shaking as she collected her clothing and entered the bathroom. She ran water in the sink while she dressed. Then she opened the door and went out. He said, I'll call you a cab.
Don't bother. I'll find my own way home.
Let me walk you down.
I'll see myself out, thank you.
At the front entrance, he grabbed her arm.
I'm sorry, Dominique. I'm just a little paranoid sometimes. You'd be paranoid, too, if you lived my life. I didn't mean anything by it. How can I make it up to you?
She said, You may take me out for a proper dinner.
What time?
Meet me at the gallery at 6:30.
Maida Vale, London. When Jacqueline returned to the flat that Gabrielle had let for her, Gabrielle was himself sitting in one of the cracked club chairs.
The phone is made by British Telecom, she reported at once.
She told him the color and model number.
There's no telephone in the bedroom, but he does have a clock radio.
What kind?
A Sony.
Again, she gave him a model number.
Let's go back to the telephone for a moment, Gabrielle said. Any distinguishing marks? Any price tags or stickers with telephone numbers on them? Anything that would give us a problem?
He fancies himself a poet and a historian. He writes all the time. It looks as though he dials the telephone with the tip of a pen. The keypad is covered with marks.
What color ink?
Blue and red.
What kind of pen?
What do you mean, the kind of pen you write with?
Gabrielle sighed and looked wearily at the ceiling.
Is it a ballpoint pen? Is it a fountain pen? Perhaps a felt-tipped pen?
Felt-tipped, I believe.
You believe?
Felt-tipped, I'm sure of it.
Very good, he said, as though he were speaking to a child. Now, is it fine point, medium, or bold?
She slowly raised the long, slender middle finger of her right hand and waved it at Gabrielle.
I'll take that to mean bold point. What about the keys?
She hunted through her handbag, tossed him the silver mascara case. Gabrielle thumbed the release, lifted the lid, looked at the imprints.
She said, We may have a problem.
Gabrielle closed the lid and looked up.
Jacqueline said,
I think he may have seen me with his keys.
Tell me about it.
She recounted the entire chain of events for him, then added cautiously,
I've arranged to meet him this evening at 6:30. Of course I can cancel if...
No, Gabrielle said, interrupting her. That's perfect. Keep him entertained long enough for me to get inside his flat and plant the bugs.
Then what?
Then it will be done.
Gabrielle left the building through a back service door. He slipped across the courtyard, scaled a cinder block wall, and leapt into an alleyway strewn with beer cans and bits of broken glass. He rode the underground to Covent Garden, where he passed the mascara case to his bordel. Then he went to an electronics store and purchased one Sony clock radio and one British Telecom phone. Now all he needed was to find the felt-tipped pens. Carp would rig the radio and the phone with mics. Gabrielle would mark up the phone keypad with ink. Kamel Azuri had been at Schloss headquarters in Zurich earlier that morning, meeting with his sales staff, when he received a text message over his pager. Mr. Taylor wished to speak to him about a problem with last Thursday's shipment. Kamel cut short his meeting, took a taxi to the Gare du Nord, and boarded the next Eurostar train to London. The timing of the message intrigued him. Mr. Taylor was the code name for an agent in London. A problem with the shipment was a code phrase for urgent. Use of the word Thursday meant the agent wished to meet on Cheyne Walk at 4:15.
I'm sorry to drag you all the way to London, Kamel, Yusuf said as they walked. But you wanted to know about every potential approach. She calls herself Dominique Bonnard.
You suspect she's lying?
I'm not sure. I can't be certain, but it's possible she was going through my things this morning. I'm supposed to meet her at the art gallery she works at in 2 hours.
Then by all means keep your date with her. In fact, I'd like the two of you to develop a very close relationship. Do you think you're up to the job?
I'll manage, Yusuf said.
I'll be in touch, Kamel said.
When Yusuf appeared at the gallery, he was not even a minute late, and he had an idea that he characterized as delicious. Instead of taking Dominique out for dinner, he would take her back to the Bayswater flat and make dinner for her himself. I'm quite good at cooking, he assured her. Bayswater. Gabrielle crossed the street, a nylon rucksack over his shoulder. Inside were the duplicate telephone and clock radio. He looked up toward the listening post. Carp had switched on the light, a signal meaning it was safe to proceed. They planned to do all their communication with light signals, though Gabrielle carried a cell phone in case of an emergency. He walked up the steps of Yusuf's building and reached into his pocket for the duplicate keys he had just picked up from his bordel. He selected the key for the front door, slipped it into the chamber, turned. It stuck. Gabrielle swore softly beneath his breath. He jiggled it back and forth, tried again. This time, the lock opened. He mounted the inside stairs. He tried the keys to Yusuf's flat. They worked perfectly. He opened the door, closed it behind him, switched on a small flashlight, and quickly played the beam around the floor next to the door. He was looking for a telltale, a scrap of paper or any other innocent-looking small object that would alert Yusuf that the flat had been entered. He saw nothing. He turned and shone the light around the room until he found the telephone. Kneeling next to it, he removed the duplicate from the rucksack and quickly compared it with the original. Perfect match. Jacqueline had done her job well. In seconds, he had the duplicate hooked in place of the original, and then he shot a glance out the window. Carp's signal light was still burning. It was safe to continue. He shoved the original phone into the rucksack as he moved from the sitting room into the bedroom. As he passed the bed, he had a disturbing image of Jacqueline's naked body writhing in rumpled sheets. He, in fact, stared at the empty bed for several seconds. "What in the hell has got into you?" he asked himself. He turned around, focused his attention on the clock radio. Before unplugging it, he checked the settings. The alarm was programmed to go off at 8 a.m. He turned on the radio. BBC Radio 5, volume low. He shut off the radio, pulled the power cord out of the wall. At that instant, his cell phone rang. He looked out the window again. The signal light was out. He had been so unnerved by the image of Jacqueline on the bed that he had forgotten to keep an eye on the listening post. He answered the phone before it could ring a second time. Carp said, "Get the fuck out of there. We have company." Gabrielle crossed the room toward the window and looked out. Jacqueline and Yusuf were getting out of a taxi. "What happened to dinner?" He turned around. Now he had a serious problem. He had unplugged Yusuf's clock radio. Now he had to plug it, or the substitute, back in and reprogram it before leaving. How long did he have? A minute? He decided to do it. He took the duplicate clock radio from the rucksack and plugged it in. The red display lights flashed. 12 o'clock. 12 o'clock. 12 o'clock. He almost had to laugh at the absurdity of the situation. The future of the operation depended on whether he could set an alarm clock quickly enough to avoid being caught. Ari Shamron had persuaded him to come back and help restore the glory of the office, but now it was going to be just another fiasco. He began pressing the hour setting button. The numbers advanced, but his fingers were trembling from the adrenaline, and he mistakenly set it for 9 o'clock instead of 8. Shit. He had to go through the entire 24-hour cycle again. The second time, he got it right. He set the current time, then switched on the radio, turned it to Radio 5, and adjusted the volume. In the taxi, Jacqueline had forced herself to calm down. Her job had been to keep Yusuf away from the flat, but if she had objected to his idea of eating dinner at home, he might have become suspicious. The chances of Gabrielle being in the flat the moment they returned were next to nothing. The entire job would take only minutes. The odds were good that he had already planted the bugs and was gone. There was another, more reassuring possibility. Gabrielle had expected Yusuf to meet her at the gallery at 6:30 and then take her to dinner. Perhaps he hadn't even entered the flat yet. He would notice that they had returned early, and he would call it off and try another time. They crossed the lobby, started up the stairs. A man passed them on the second floor landing, Gabrielle, head down, rucksack over his shoulder. Jacqueline flinched involuntarily. She regained her composure, but not before Yusuf noticed that she was rattled. He stopped and watched Gabrielle walking down the stairs, then looked at Jacqueline. He took her by the arm and led her to the door. When they entered the flat, he looked around the room quickly, then walked to the window and watched Gabrielle walking away through the darkness. Lisbon. The meeting took place in the narrow alleys of the Alfama district.
"Tell me about London," Tariq said.
"It looks as though Alon has made his first move," Kamel answered.
"That didn't take long. What happened?"
Kamel told him about Yusuf and the girl from the art gallery.
"Yusuf noticed a strange man in his block of flats last night. He thinks the man may have been an Israeli. He thinks he may have planted a bug in his flat."
Kamel could see Tariq was already calculating the possibilities.
"Is this agent of yours a man who can be trusted with an important assignment?"
"He's a very intelligent young man, and very loyal. I knew his father. He was killed by the Israelis in 82.
"Has he looked for the bug?"
"I told him not to."
"Good," Tariq said. "Leave it in place. We can use it to our advantage. What about this girl? Is she still in the picture?"
"I've instructed Yusuf to continue seeing her."
"What's she like?"
"Apparently quite attractive."
"Do you have the resources in London to follow her?"
"Absolutely."
"Do it. And get me a photograph of her."
"You have an idea?"
They passed through a small square, then started up a long, steep hill. By the time they had reached the top, Tariq had explained the entire thing.
"It's brilliant," Kamel said. "But it has one flaw."
"What's that?"
"You won't survive it."
Tariq smiled sadly and said,
"That's the best news I've heard in a very long time."
He turned and walked away. A moment later, he had vanished into the fog. Kamel shivered. He turned up the collar of his coat. As long as he was in Lisbon, he would go to the Barro Alto and listen to fado music. Bayswater, London. The operation settled into a comfortable, if rather dull, routine. Gabrielle spent endless stretches of time with nothing to do but listen to the trivial details of Yusuf's life, which played out on his monitors like a dreadful radio drama. Yusuf chatting on the telephone. Yusuf arguing politics over cigarettes and Turkish coffee with his Palestinian friends. Yusuf telling a heartbroken girl he could no longer see her because he was involved seriously with another. Gabrielle found his life moving to the rhythm of Yusuf's. He ate when Yusuf ate, slept when Yusuf slept, and when Yusuf made love to Jacqueline, Gabrielle made love to her too. But after 10 days, Gabrielle's bugs had picked up nothing of value. There were several possible explanations. Perhaps Shamron had simply made a mistake. Perhaps Yusuf really was just a waiter and a student. Perhaps he was an agent but was inactive. Or perhaps he was an active agent, but was talking with his comrades through other means, signal sites and other forms of impersonal communication. To detect that, Gabrielle would have to mount a full-scale round-the-clock surveillance operation. It would require multiple teams, at least a dozen officers, safe flats, vehicles, radios. An operation like that would be difficult to conceal from MI5, the British Security Service. But there was one other possibility that troubled Gabrielle most. the possibility that the operation was already blown. Perhaps his surveillance had turned up nothing because Yusuf already suspected he was being watched. Perhaps he suspected that his flat was bugged and his telephones tapped. And perhaps he suspected that the beautiful French girl from the art gallery was actually an Israeli agent. Gabriel decided it was time for another face-to-face meeting with Shamron in Paris. He met Shamron the following morning in a tea shop on the Rue Mouffetard, and then they walked slowly up the hill through the markets and street stalls. "Something doesn't feel right," Gabriel said. "I want to pull her out before it's too late."
"No," Shamron said. "Unthinkable."
He looked at Gabriel carefully and added,
"Why is your face fallen, Gabriel? Are you listening to the tapes before you send them to me?" "Of course I am." "Can't you hear what's going on? The endless lectures on the suffering of the Palestinians, the ruthlessness of the Israelis, the recitation of Palestinian poetry, all the old folklore about how beautiful life was in Palestine before the Jews? What's your point?" "Either the boy is in love, or he has something else on his mind." "It's the second possibility that concerns me. Has it ever occurred to you that maybe Yusuf thinks of her as more than just a pretty girl? Has it ever occurred to you that he thinks of her as an impressionable girl who might be useful to Tariq and his organization?" "It has, but she's not prepared for that kind of operation, and frankly, neither are we." "So you want to fold up your tent and go home?"
"No, I just want to pull Jacqueline out."
"And then what happens? Yusuf gets nervous. Yusuf gets suspicious and tears apart his flat. If he's disciplined, he throws out every electrical appliance in the place, and your microphones go with them."
"If we handle her departure skillfully, he'll never suspect a thing. Besides, when I hired her, I promised her a short-term job. You know she has other commitments."
"None more important than this. Pay her wages, full price. She stays, Gabriel. End of discussion."
On the train back to London, Gabriel entered the lavatory and locked the door. He stood for a long time in front of the mirror. There were lines around his eyes, he noticed, a sudden tightness at the corners of his mouth, a knife edge to his cheekbones. What he saw took him back to the Black September operation. Afterwards, he lost the ability to sleep. Shamron got a doctor to prescribe powerful tranquilizers, and the pills and the stress together made Gabriel look shockingly older. Though he was only 22 at the time, he looked 40. When he went home, Leah barely recognized him. When they made love, she said it was like sleeping with another man. Not an older version of Gabriel, but a complete stranger. In the lavatory, Gabriel splashed cold water on his face, scrubbed vigorously with a paper towel, then studied his reflection once more. The same. He contemplated the chain of events, the bizarre roulette wheel of fate, that had led him to this place. Had there been no Hitler, no Holocaust, his parents would have remained in Europe instead of fleeing to a dusty agriculture settlement in the Jezreel Valley. Before the war, his father had been an essayist and historian in Munich, his mother a gifted painter in Prague, and neither had adjusted well to the collectivism of the settlement or the Zionist zeal for manual labor. They had treated Gabriel more as a miniature adult than a boy with needs different from their own. He was expected to entertain and look after himself. His earliest childhood memory was of their small two-room house on the settlement. His father reading in his chair, his mother at her easel, Gabriel on the floor between them, building cities with crude blocks. His parents detested Hebrew, so when they were alone they used the languages they had spoken in Europe, German, French, Czech, Russian, Yiddish. Gabriel absorbed them all. To his European languages he added Hebrew and Arabic. From his father he also took a flawless memory. From his mother, unshakable patience and attention to detail. Their disdain for the collective had bred in him arrogance and a lone wolf attitude. Their secular agnosticism had encumbered him with no sense of Jewish morality or ethics. He preferred hiking to football, reading to agriculture. He had an almost pathological fear of getting his hands dirty. He had many secrets. When the train reached Waterloo, Gabriel made his way to the underground car park. He found his car, dropped his keys, engaged in his ritualistic inspection, then climbed inside and drove to Surrey. There was no sign at the gate. Gabriel had always wanted a place with no sign. Beyond the wall was a well-tended lawn with evenly spaced trees. At the end of a meandering drive stood a rambling red-brick Victorian mansion. He lowered the car window and pressed the button of the intercom. "I'm here to see Miss Martinson," he explained. "Dr. Avery is expecting me." He raised the window, waited for the automatic security gate to roll aside, then he entered the grounds and headed slowly up the drive. Late afternoon, cold and gray, light wind chasing through the trees. Avery was waiting in the entrance hall. He wore expensive corduroy trousers, the color of rust and neatly pressed, and a gray cashmere pullover sweater that looked more suited to the golf links than a psychiatric hospital. He shook Gabriel's hand with a cold formality, then led him down a long carpeted hallway.
"She's been speaking quite a bit more this month," Avery said. "We've actually had a meaningful conversation on a couple of occasions."
Gabriel managed a tense smile. In all these years, she had never spoken to him.
"And her physical health?" he asked. "No change, really. She's as fit as can be expected."
As they walked, he talked medication. He had increased the dosage of one drug, reduced another, taken her off a third altogether. There was a new drug, an experimental, that was showing some promising results in patients suffering from a similar combination of acute post-traumatic stress syndrome and psychotic depression.
"If you think it will help, we'll never know unless we try."
At the door to the solarium, Avery left him.
"She's in her usual place," he said. "She's expecting you. Try to keep it to half an hour."
Leah sat in a straight-backed garden chair of wrought iron. She wore the white roll-neck sweater Gabriel had given her for her last birthday, the white trousers he had bought for her during a summer holiday in Crete. Gabriel tried to remember the year, but couldn't. There seemed to be only Leah before Vienna and Leah after Vienna. She sat with a schoolgirl's primness, looking away across the expanse of the lawn. Her hair had been cut institutionally short. Her feet were bare. She turned her head as Gabriel approached, and he saw the scarring on the right side of her face. As always, it made him feel violently cold. Then he saw her hands, or what was left of her hands. The hard white scar tissue reminded him of the exposed canvas of a damaged painting. He kissed her forehead. She flinched and looked away.
"No longer a person," he thought. "A gravestone."
Though he used to try to talk to her, now he was content to just sit in her presence. He sat for 45 minutes. Then he pulled closer to her, placed a hand on her knee.
"I have to go," he said.
He was about to stand when suddenly she reached out and touched the side of his face. Gabriel tried not to recoil at the sensation of the scar tissue sliding along the skin at the corner of his eye. She smiled sadly and lowered her hand. She placed it in her lap, covered it with the other, resumed the frozen pose Gabriel had found her in. He stood and walked away. He knew, as always, that her grip on life, however tenuous, was somehow linked to his continued fidelity to her. If he allowed himself to fall in love with someone else, Leah would die. Lisbon. This time, Kamel had a color photograph for Tariq.
"Meet Dominique Bonnar," he said.
Tariq studied the picture carefully. Then he said,
"Yes, I think I may know her."
He thought for a moment, then he continued.
My brother, Mahmoud, was in bed when he was killed. He had a girl with him, a German student, a radical. She wrote a letter to my parents a few weeks after Mahmoud was killed and told them how it happened. She said she would never forget the face of the assassin as long as she lived. My father took the letter to the PLO security officer in the camp. The security officer turned it over to PLO intelligence. After Abu Jihad was murdered in Tunis, PLO security conducted an investigation. They worked from the simple premise that the killer must have had the villa under surveillance for some time. So they began reviewing all the videotape from the surveillance cameras. They found several shots of a small, dark-haired man.
Tariq paused to make sure that Kamel was following him.
Our intelligence then showed these photographs to the German girl. They'd kept track of her over the years, and she said it was the same man who had killed Mahmoud. No doubt about it. So we started looking for him.
And you found him in Vienna?
That's right.
What does this have to do with Dominique Bonnard?
Someone looking an awful lot like her appears in one of the surveillance pictures with Alon.
On the evening of the same day, they reviewed the plan one last time as they walked through the twisting alleys of the Alfama.
The Prime Minister and Arafat leave for the United States in 5 days, Kamel said. They're going to Washington first for a meeting at the White House, then it's off to New York for the signing ceremony at the United Nations. Everything is in place in New York.
Now I just need a traveling companion, Tariq said. I think I'd like a beautiful French woman, the type of woman who would look good on the arm of a successful entrepreneur.
I think I know where I can find a woman like that.
Imagine killing the peace process and Gabriel Alon in one final moment of glory. We're going to shake the world, Kamel. And then I'm going to leave it.
Are you sure you want to go through with this?
You're not concerned about my safety at this point.
Of course I am.
Why? You know what's happening to me.
Actually, I try not to think about it.
Kamel moved to take leave, but Tariq gripped his shoulders and kissed his cheeks.
No tears, my brother, he said. I've been fighting for a long time. I'm tired. It's best this way.
He released his grip on Kamel's shoulders and added,
He should have killed the girl.
What? Kamel answered.
Alon should have killed the German girl who was with my brother. It would all have ended there.
I suppose you're right.
It was a stupid mistake, Tariq said. I wouldn't have made a mistake like that.
St. James's, London. Jacqueline read the letter from Randolph Stewart, private art dealer, that a bicycle courier had just delivered. Just back from Paris, very good trip, no problems with the acquisition, continue with sale as planned. She placed the letter in Isherwood's shredder and watched it turn to paper linguine. It was 5 o'clock. She put her head into Isherwood's office to say goodbye for the evening, and she realized that she would miss him when it was all over. He was a decent man. She wondered how he had become entangled with the likes of Ari Shamron and Gabriel. She felt little enthusiasm for what lay immediately ahead of her. She would meet Yusuf at his flat. They would go to dinner, then return to his flat and make love. Then 2 hours of Middle East history. The injustices heaped upon the defenseless Palestinians. The crimes of the Jews. The inequity of the two-state solution on the negotiating table. Gabrielle had promised her a short assignment, not the long-term romance it was turning into. But there was something else. She had agreed to come to London because she thought working with Gabrielle would rekindle their romance. If anything, it had driven them farther apart. She rarely saw him. He communicated through letters. And the few times they had been together, he had been cold and distant. She had been a fool to think things could ever be the way they had been in Tunis. She entered the Piccadilly Underground station and walked to the crowded platform. She thought of her villa, of cycling through the sun-drenched hillsides around Valbonne. For a moment she imagined Gabriel riding next to her, his legs pumping rhythmically. Then she felt silly for allowing herself to think about such things. When the train came, she squeezed her way into the packed carriage and clung to a metal handhold. As the car lurched forward, she decided this would be the last night. In the morning, she would tell Gabriel she wanted out. Gabriel paced the carpet of the listening post, casually dribbling a lime-green tennis ball with his stocking feet. It was shortly before midnight. Jacqueline and Yusuf had just finished making love. He listened to their mutual declarations of physical pleasure. He listened to Yusuf using the toilet. He listened to Jacqueline padding into the kitchen for something to drink. He heard her ask Yusuf where he had hidden her cigarettes. Gabriel lay on the couch, head propped on the armrest, and tossed the ball toward the ceiling while he waited for Yusuf to begin tonight's seminar. He wondered what the topic would be. What was it last night? The myth that only the Jews made the desert bloom. No, that was the night before. Last night had been the betrayal of the Palestinians by the rest of the Arab world. He switched off the lamp and continued tossing the ball and catching it in the dark to test his reflexes and sensory perception. A door opening, the snap of a light switch. Yusuf said somberly, "We need to talk. I misled you about something. I need to tell you the truth now." Gabriel snatched the tennis ball out of the darkness and held it very still in the palm of his hand. He thought of Leah, the night she used those same words before telling him that she had retaliated for his infidelity by taking lovers of her own. Jacqueline said lightheartedly,
"Sounds awfully serious."
Gabriel sent the ball floating upward through the darkness with a subtle flick of his wrist.
"It's about this scar on my back."
Gabriel got to his feet and switched on the lamp. Then he checked his tape decks to make certain they were recording properly.
"It was after the assassination of Bashir Gemayel," Yusuf began. "He was the leader of Lebanon's Maronite Christians and the president-elect of the country. Well, a lot of people thought the Palestinians were to blame for this, so the Israelis let the Falangist militia into the refugee camps to purge them. The Israelis let the first Falangists into Shatila, where we were, at sunset. There were maybe 150 of them, and the slaughter lasted 48 hours. Do you know what they did? They skinned people alive. They chopped people to bits. They gouged out eyes and left people to wander the carnage blindly until they were shot. They tied people to trucks and dragged them through the streets until they were dead. Children weren't spared either. A child could grow up to be a terrorist, according to the Falangists, so they killed all the children. Women weren't spared because a woman could give birth to a terrorist. They made a point of ritualistically slicing off the breasts of the Palestinian women. Breasts give milk. Breasts nourish a people that the Falangists wanted to exterminate. All through the night they broke into homes and slaughtered everyone inside. When darkness fell, the Israelis lit up the sky with flares so that Falangists could go about their work more easily."
Jacqueline made a steeple of her fingers and pressed them against her lips. Yusuf continued with his account.
"I was just 7 at the time. My father was dead. He was killed that summer when the Israelis shelled the camps during the Battle of Beirut. I lived in Shatila with my mother and my sister. She was just 1.5 years old at the time. We hid beneath our bed, listening to the screaming and the gunfire, watching the shadows of the flares dancing on the walls. We prayed that the Falangists would somehow miss our house, but they didn't. When they finally broke down our door, one of the Falangists grabbed me by the hair and dragged me outside. He stripped off my shirt and used a knife to slice away the skin on the center of my back. Then they tied me to a truck and dragged me through the streets. At some point I went unconscious, but before I blacked out I remember the Falangists shooting at me. They were using me for target practice. Somehow, I survived. Maybe they thought I was dead, I don't know. My mother was not so fortunate. She was raped. Her breasts were sliced off. Then she was murdered. My sister had been cut into pieces that they laid out on the kitchen table. Jacqueline tumbled out of bed, crawled into the bathroom, and was violently sick. Yusuf knelt beside her and placed a hand on her back as her body retched. When she finished, he said, "You ask me why I hate the Israelis so much. I hate them because they sent the phalangists to massacre us. I hate them because they stood by and did nothing while Christians, their great friends in Lebanon, raped and slaughtered us. Now you know why I'm a rejectionist when it comes to this so-called peace process. How can I trust these people?"
"I understand."
"Do you really understand, Dominique? Is it possible?"
"I suppose not."
"Now I've been completely honest with you about everything. Is there anything you wish to tell me about yourself? Any secrets you've been keeping from me?"
"Nothing of any consequence."
"You're telling me the truth, Dominique?"
"Yes."
The call came at 4:15 that morning. It woke Yusuf, though not Gabriel. He had been sitting up all morning, listening to Yusuf's account of the refugee camps over and over again. It rang just once. Yusuf, his voice heavy with sleep, said, "Hello."
"Lancaster Gate, tomorrow, 2 o'clock.
Click. Jacqueline said,
"What was that?"
"A wrong number. Go back to sleep."
Maida Vale in mourning. A gang of schoolboys teasing a pretty girl. Jacqueline imagined they were phalangist militiamen armed with knives and axes. A lorry roared past, belching diesel fumes. Jacqueline saw a man tied to the bumper being dragged to death. Her block of flats loomed in front of her. She looked up and imagined Israeli soldiers standing on the roof, watching the slaughter below through binoculars, firing flares so the killers could better see their victims. She entered the building, climbed the stairs, and slipped into the flat. Gabriel was sitting on the couch.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"Tell you what?"
"Why didn't you tell me he had survived Shatila? Why didn't you tell me his family had been butchered like that?"
"What difference would it have made?"
"I just wish I had known."
She lit a cigarette and inhaled deeply.
"Is it true? Are the things he told me true?"
"Which part?"
"All of it, Gabriel. Don't play fucking games with me."
"Yes, it's true. His family died at Shatila. He suffered. So what? We've all suffered. It doesn't give him the right to murder innocent people because history didn't go his way."
"He was an innocent, Gabriel. He was just a boy."
"We're in the middle of an operation, Jacqueline. Now is not the time for a debate on moral equivalence and the ethics of counterterrorism."
"I apologize for permitting the question of morality to enter my thoughts. I forgot you and Shamron never get tripped up over something so trivial."
"Don't lump me in with Shamron."
"Why not? Because he gives orders and you follow them?"
"What about Tunis?" Gabriel asked. "You knew Tunis was an assassination job, but you willingly took part in it. You even volunteered to go back the night of the killing."
"That's because the target was Abu Jihad. He had the blood of hundreds of Israelis and Jews on his hands."
"This one has blood on his hands too. Don't forget that."
"He's just a boy whose family was butchered while the Israeli army looked on and did nothing."
"He's not a boy. He's a 25-year-old man who helps Tariq kill people."
"And you're going to use him to get to Tariq because of what Tariq did to you? When does it end? When there's no more blood to shed? When, Gabriel?"
He stood up and pulled on his jacket. Jacqueline said,
"I want out."
"You can't leave now."
"Yes, I can. I don't want to sleep with Yusuf anymore."
Why?
Why? You have the nerve to ask me why.
I'm sorry, Jacqueline. That didn't come out.
You think of me as a whore, don't you, Gabriel? You think it doesn't bother me to sleep with the men I don't care for?
That's not true.
Is that what I was to you in Tunis? Just a whore?
You know that's not true.
Then tell me what I was.
You were... I care for you, Jacqueline. I care for you very much.
Hyde Park, London. Karp said, "Your friend picked a damned lousy place for a meeting." They were sitting in the back of a white Ford van on the Bayswater Road a few yards from Lancaster Gate. Karp hunched over the console of audio equipment, adjusting his levels. Gabriel could scarcely hear himself think over the riotous din of cars, taxis, lorries, and double-decker buses. Gabriel said, "How many listeners do you have out there?" "Three," Karp said. "The guy on the bench who looks like a banker, the pretty girl tossing bread to the ducks, and the guy selling ice cream just inside the gate."
"Not bad," Gabriel said.
"Under these conditions, don't expect any miracles." Gabriel looked at his wristwatch, 2:03. He thought,
"He's not going to show. They've spotted Karp's team and they're aborting."
It was just then, though, that Yusuf emerged from Westbourne Street and darted across the road in front of a charging delivery truck. Karp snapped a couple of photographs as Yusuf entered the park and strolled around the fountains. During the middle of his second circuit, he was joined by a man wearing a gray woolen overcoat, face obscured by sunglasses and a felt hat. Karp switched to a longer lens, took several more photographs. Yusuf and his contact spoke in English, but because of all the racket, Gabriel could make out only every third or fourth word. And the girl who had been feeding the ducks was following much too close behind them. Karp delivered the tape to Gabriel at the listening post 3 hours later, with the resigned air of a surgeon who had done all he could to save the patient. "I fed it through the computers, filtered out the background noise, and enhanced the good stuff. What we got was barely 10%. Gabriel slipped the cassette into the deck and began listening. "Need someone. Next assignment." A sound, like static turned up full blast, obliterated the rest of the sentence. Gabriel paused the tape and looked at Karp. "It's the fountain," Karp said. "There's nothing I can do with it." Gabriel restarted the tape. "Check out her. In Paris. Problems. Things fine." Gabriel stopped the tape, pressed rewind, then play. "Check out her. In Paris. Problems. Things fine." Then there was this, a full sentence. "Don't worry, Yusuf. Your girlfriend won't say no to you." Stop. Rewind. Play. "Don't worry, Yusuf. Your girlfriend won't say no to you." That evening, Jacqueline picked up curry after work and brought it to Yusuf's flat. While they ate, they watched an American film on television about a German terrorist on the loose in Manhattan. Gabriel watched along with them. He muted his own television and listened to Yusuf's instead. When the film was over, Yusuf pronounced it "total crap" and shut off the television. Then he said,
"We need to talk about something, Dominique. I need to ask you something important."
Gabriel closed his eyes and listened. Next morning, Jacqueline stepped off the carriage at the Piccadilly Underground station and floated along with the crowd across the platform. As she rode up the escalator, she looked around her. They had to be following her, Yusuf's watchers. He wouldn't let her loose on the streets of London without a secret escort, not after what he had asked her to do last night. A black-haired man was staring at her from a parallel escalator. When he caught her eye, he smiled and tried to hold her gaze. She realized he was only a lecher. She turned and looked straight ahead. Outside, as she walked along Piccadilly, she thought she spotted Gabrielle using a public telephone. But it was only a Gabrielle look-alike. She thought she saw him again stepping out of a taxi, but it was only Gabrielle's non-existent younger brother. She realized there were versions of Gabrielle all around her. Boys in leather jackets, young men in stylish business suits, artists, students, delivery boys. With minor alterations, Gabrielle could pass for any of them. Isherwood had arrived early. He looked, she thought, hungover. She glanced at the morning mail on her desk, then at a manila envelope that had arrived by courier. She tore open the flap, removed the letter from inside. "I'm going to Paris," the letter said. "Don't set foot outside the gallery until you hear from me." She squeezed it into a tight ball. Paris. At the entrance to a residential building near the Bois de Boulogne, Gabrielle pressed the button for 4B, which bore the name Guzman in faded blue script. When the phone rattled on the other end, he murmured a few words, replaced the receiver, waited for the door to open. He crossed the foyer, rode the lift to the fourth floor, and knocked softly on the door of the flat. He heard a chain sliding away, then a deadbolt snapping. The man who drew him inside, no handshake, was of Gabrielle's own height, square of head and shoulders, with steel-blue eyes and strawberry-blonde hair. Gabrielle thought that he seemed inordinately pleased with himself, like a man who had had too much success with women. Shamron, in a haze of cigarette smoke, rose from a couch and held out his parched hand.
"You have the tapes?"
Gabrielle looked at the other man.
"Who's this?"
"This is Uzi Navot. Uzi's Arkatza in Paris now, one of my best men. He's been working with me on this case. Meet the great Gabrielle Allon, Uzi."
Gabrielle could see that Navot was one of Shamron's acolytes. The office was full of them, men who would do anything, betray, cheat, steal, even kill, in order to win Shamron's approval. Navot was young and he was brash, and there was a smugness about him that made Gabrielle dislike him instantly. He shone like a newly minted coin. The instructors at the academy had told him he was a member of the elite, a prince, and Navot had believed them. Gabrielle handed Shamron the tapes. Shamron inserted the first of them into the stereo system, then pressed play, and Yusuf began to speak. Gabrielle thought that Shamron looked as though he were listening to the strains of distant music.
"A friend of mine," Yusuf was saying, "a very important Palestinian, needs to make a trip abroad for a crucial meeting. Unfortunately, the Zionists and their friends would rather this man not attend this important meeting, and if they spot him during his journey, they'll probably seize him and send him back home."
"Why would they do that?"
"Because he has dared to question the fairness of the so-called peace process. Because he has dared to challenge the Palestinian leadership. Because he believes the only just solution to the Palestinian problem is to allow us to go back to our homes, wherever they might be, and to establish a truly binational state in the land of Palestine."
"What do you want from me?"
"Because this man is under constant threat, he finds it necessary to take certain precautions. When he travels, he does so under an assumed name. He's very educated, and he speaks many languages. He can pass for several different nationalities."
"I still don't know what you want from me, Yusuf."
"The passport control officers of all Western countries use what's known as profiling to single out travelers for closer scrutiny. Unfortunately, because of the phenomenon of Arab terrorism, Arab men traveling alone are subject to the harshest scrutiny of all. Therefore, this man prefers to travel under a Western passport and with another person, a woman."
"Why a woman?"
"Because a man and woman traveling together are less suspicious than two men. This man needs a traveling companion, a partner, if you will. I'd like you to go with him on this trip."
Why me?
For one reason, your appearance. You are a very attractive, very distracting woman. But also because of your passport.